All right. That was really special. And all right, our next group is all ready and moving on up. This is great. We're going to focus on Rights Tech in the Enterprise and Vicky Nauman, after her crazy airline saga last night, is here to lead the panel as our moderator. So, Vicky, I'll turn it over to you when you're ready. Chairs for everybody? Do we need one more? Let's see. Because there is another one down here.
Well, thank you very much. And that was kind of, this is kind of a hard act to follow. And I thought that last session was great, because in this industry, a lot of times you hear people saying, oh, artists and songwriters, you know, they just want to create their art. They don't understand anything about all of these complexities. And it's like, yeah, I think they do. I think they do. But this is a panel about rights in the enterprise, and we've got a mix of service providers, licensees, and licensors, so it's going to be a really good discussion about some of the motivations that get companies into the rights management business when they never thought that they would find themselves there, and some of the complexities and some of the advice that people on this panel from their expertise might give around avoiding some of those pitfalls. So first introductions, and I'm Vicky Nauman, moderating the panel. I've done more licensing than is advisable in this space, so I've developed a knowledge on this that I didn't really think that I ever wanted to have. But we've got a great panel, so I'd love for you to each introduce yourselves, please.
Sure. So I'm Chris Reed, Senior Counsel for Content Protection Policy at Fox Entertainment Group in Los Angeles. I'm also working as an advisor to a New York-based startup called Orange Genius, which you heard about a little bit this morning, that's working on developing a platform to help artists manage their work and grow their businesses. So I come at this from a couple different perspectives.
And I'm Chris Kleeman. I have spent a professional lifetime working in book publishing, book and journal publishing companies, as the head of rights and licensing content out, obviously closely connected also to the acquisition of content in.
Thank you. I'm Sam Gilchrist, founder and CEO of Pluravita. Pluravita is a software manufacturer focused on providing distributors and content owners and other types of rights holders with a settlement infrastructure that both manages and asserts their rights, as well as keeps track of what's actually being sold or used, and then manages the payment process to make sure that all parties are actually being paid properly.
Hi, I'm Elisa Coleman. I'm the COO of Abco Music and Records, Inc. We're one of the largest independent music publishing and record companies, representing the works of Sam Cooke, Bobby Womack, the Rolling Stones, and others.
I'm Bill Coulter. I'm the Vice President and General Counsel of Music Reports. We are a neutral technology platform for the administration of music rights, and we operate Songdex, which is the largest database of music rights information in the world.
Bill, can you move your mic just a little closer? I think it was not picking you up there. So in the olden days, when we had radio and record stores and bookshops, they were retailers that were selling things. Now we have a distribution network that is often made up of companies that are software companies or hardware companies. In all of your experience, and please come at this from whichever angle you want, because many of you are wearing multiple hats or have done multiple things, why is there this attraction to content and integrating music or books or other kinds of media into the business that is very, very different from that? The core business may be something that has absolutely nothing to do with rights management.
Okay.
Why do people come to you and want to talk to you about
your
great catalog?
Right. Obviously, we have great catalog, and there's a demand for consumers to you know, experience that catalog in a vast realm of different ways, you know, whether it's streaming, whether it's downloading, whether it's buying a piece of physical product, whether it's using it in a television show or in a commercial. You know, we have to figure out ways to make that work because we are in the business of allowing people to hear and experience that content. That's the gift that we have to give. And the artists create these great works, whether it's them as a songwriter or them as the performing artist, and we need to make them available. The challenge in making them available is how do we then go about collecting the value proposition of this intellectual property and making sure that it gets distributed correctly to us and correctly to our artists and our songwriters. That's where the real problems come into play at this point.
I think for us, we work with both music and video distributors across YouTube and a variety of other platforms. And what we found is companies who kind of had a pretty exciting model or had some value they were going to add to distribution, like the ability to monetize it, like the ability to build audiences around it. The first thing they looked at after that was, oh my gosh, all these transactions are coming back to us. I signed all of these deals with these creators who are standing with me and behind me so that I can actually distribute their content. So I need some kind of platform to manage their interest as well as mine. When you look at the new creators, that are, we've obviously seen what happens when we have user-generated content, but when we look at new creators, they're creating content primarily to build audiences, not necessarily initially to monetize. They go to distributors and to other rights holders and ask for permission or otherwise use their content in order to get lift with audiences. And no matter what, they're creating a lot of complexity in their business as a result of it, which is why they affiliate with networks. Networks then have this enviable job to figure out, well, how do I get you paid now that all of this activity is coming back? So from us, we've looked at how to be as flexible as possible to serve that entire value stream. Whether you're the content owner, whether you're an affiliated or an ancillary rights holder, or whether you're the distributor working with a variety of aggregators or other platforms in a syndication model.
I think I have to speak up for text. Nothing against music. But until very recently, I worked for about 13 years at Wiley, John Wiley & Sons, which is a big publishing company, books and journals, wide variety of different kinds of content, and people would come to us for different reasons depending on the type of content. So if you're talking about scientific and medical research, there are uses for that that are very different than Puppies for Dummies, which was another very popular book I wrote, or Guitar for Dummies. So there are different reasons why people want content. My department functioned on behalf of the original content creators and on behalf of the company to drive revenue around it. It was our obligation. Having acquired those rights, it was an obligation to try then to monetize or exploit or maximize, however you want to say it, those rights. I mean, nobody writes a book to have it be privished, right? It's supposed to be published. So you want a lot of people to have it in a lot of different incarnations. So sometimes people were asking, but more often than not, we were trying to go out and find new markets for it. Hence the need for the rights management, to know what rights we had.
And from the film studio perspective, I think we've been seeing, you know, an increased interest in new distribution models, and you heard a lot of that this morning from our industry colleagues from places like the Discovery Channel, where we're looking at just new ways of distributing content, new people coming to us, new players in a market that we're not used to playing in, all kinds of unusual contract terms that we need to work out, and that has implications for downstream revenue participants. So you heard this morning a little bit about how we have obligations to, you know, writers, directors, actors that get a chunk of the back end. Every new business model, every new distribution model requires that we reevaluate how that works or try to shoehorn it into an existing framework with, you know, varying degrees of success. On the visual art side, putting on my other hat for a minute, I think we've seen a rapid and unprecedented explosion in the amount of visual content that is out there. owing largely to cheapening cameras less expensive cameras, processing tools and things like that are creating, you know, making everybody a photographer, everybody an artist. At the same time, we've seen an explosion in the amount, the number of people wanting to use that visual content. And the mismatch in between there is that there's a real misunderstanding about copyright. I was a copyright lawyer. I spent a lot of time before I came to Fox as a lawyer at the Copyright Office, and we did a lot of education and outreach initiatives there. People really have this sense that if it's on the internet, it's free. And for graphic images, that is a particularly big issue because it's so easy to take them and incorporate them into new works. And so that's one of the challenges, and I think that gives rise to a lot of these companies that are like the one I'm working with that are trying to create platforms to help monetize those works.
Yeah, so that's great segue because at the very surface we see something that looks like a perfect match, right? You know, supply of creative works and demand to exploit those works and to get them to consumers. So there's, at the core, there's something really good about all of the innovative technologies, the new distribution channels, new models. Is it around, where does that start to break down? Is it around the complexity of managing the rights? Is it just not understanding that creators need to get compensated? Or what is the value to creators? Or is it just the sheer management of the data and the systems that are needed to manage intellectual property rights?
Well, if I can just feed off of something that he said just a minute ago, I mean, one thing that hasn't been observed yet today is that we're at a point of massive transformation caused by the advent of digital media, right? The copyright law that existed for 300 years was based on centralized means of mass reproduction. Now the means of mass reproduction are everywhere you look, right? We've all become creators and consumers at the same time, which has massively proliferated the amount of content that's available to be administered. Just one simple example of it is the long tail of sound recordings we see coming into the marketplace. There's, 70-something million tracks in the iTunes database, but every month there's 500,000 to 1 million new tracks coming into that system, which means we're in an accelerating trend toward more sound recordings being produced and commercially released all the time, which is, of course, being driven by the aggregators, which, as someone observed earlier, makes it possible for anybody with a garage band or two turntables and a microphone to have a commercial release of whatever that's worth. So there's just many, many more pieces of content to be tracked. Everyone with a digital photo camera has insane numbers of photographs that need to be tracked, and those get lost along with those of professional photographers. So this is the ecosystem we're in. It was already problematic, and then digital media just compounded the problems.
And then along the way, when you find people that want to use your content, you have to weigh the value of that use and what it means to your artist and what it means to the exposure of that artist and the legacy of that artist. I mean, we take our fiduciary responsibility we consider it very important to make sure that the artist portrays themselves and their legacy in the way that they want. So we don't necessarily agree to license every service, and when we do agree to license a service, we need to go through every incarnation of the rights that are being granted, the detail that we're being reported to, and how that's going to interact with our system. Being a small company, you know, taking in the data, massive, massive reams of data can be overwhelming. How do we manage that? How do we make sure that it's properly dealt with? So it's important that we deal with that on the contract level.
How do you evaluate the value of a potential opportunity when it's an opportunity in the future?
Well, we take into consideration the mass exposure and the way that the material is being used. Different distribution models, just streaming as a whole. You know, some instances, with my music publisher hat on, I don't necessarily get a choice, okay, because of the copyright law. But with my record company hat on, I need to make sure that my product is going to be used and leveraged in a way that's going to grow the value of that content and not just be placed in order to grow the value of that service.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, that's the key negotiation point, isn't it?
Right.
What you know, what's in it for me, what's in it for you?
Right.
And trying to figure out where the balance is on that. And it's very hard when completely new distribution channels or products come to life, you know. It's a challenge. And I think traditionally, especially in book publishing, people were very much about squeezing as little out of the toothpaste tube as possible for as much money as possible. And then we're now in a world of abundance, you know, and why would you wanna, again, I go back to the whole thing of the point is to have the information out there, not that it gets away from us, that it becomes something that we no longer have any say in, but that you want to have it out as much as possible. So trying to figure out how to play with those and what terms you put around that, limited time periods, limited territories, tests, betas, all those kinds of things that you try to work out to experiment in the marketplace.
Well, I think the way the evaluation process has evolved over, say, the last 10 years, having had the privilege to be a part of the launching of some pretty large social networks, to be a part of some very large video service launches, to be a part of what you would call, I guess, although it's a dying term now, multi-channel network launches, and the scaling of those properties. Whereas before you, when you were a content owner or you were aggregating rights for the purposes of distributing, you were generally thinking about direct-to-consumer experience. You were thinking, you know, how do I get this on the right shelf space, or even getting it in the right playlist to make sure the consumers are going to engage with it and maybe essentially purchase it. Streaming services came along. Those streaming services in those different models I kind of laid out started thinking more about engagement around audience development in order to think about monetizing content in a different way. Not necessarily a sale. Obviously, it was disintermediating certain types of business models, but in a way, it was setting up how consumers were actually going to interact. So you have audience development is the big, big driver. The later incarnations of those distributors look at their brand attractiveness. So they now represent a type of platform that brands want to orient around because they're building content and talent and personalities, music and video related, that are going to give more value to everyone that's involved in the transactions that are coming back. So the evaluation process, it actually kind of is the same no matter what. It's about value as it evolved. It's just the velocity of that is picked up to the point where, I mean, I love the way you said, you know, the deluge of transaction data coming back at you, because it's not just that, it's also the myriad rules that you've actually agreed to that now have to be operationalized in your enterprise to be able to make good on what you're doing for your partners. And generally, you're talking about the creative side. You're saying, I'm going to make sure I'm taking care of you, and I'm going to make sure you're getting paid properly. Not only am I going to manage your image, not only am I going to help you manage your reach to your audience, but I'm going to make sure that everything is accounted for. But it feels like the trade is still the same. It's just the audience is getting bigger. The players who are being invited in are much more complex. In some cases, they're trying to programmatically involve themselves in a relationship between you, their audience, excuse me, and the content that you're going to be providing. So that's sort of where the discussions earlier this morning around sort of blockchain and the potential for sort of the point of sale and the instant value distribution, it has some legs. I mean, it's certainly, at least at some point, there is an opportunity to initially recognize a value transfer. We generally sit at the point of sale as well, and the point of use with our marketing technology where we're tracking what's happening. However, there are still layers of rights that have to be honored, and therefore a value system that you need to make sure you're paying. You're not going to change that because the creative industry is pretty big. I mean, it, even if you're talking about a guy, you know, in a garage on a computer, he's generally sampling in most cases, so he's automatically invoking the rights, or at least liability, for the use of the content. So to me, it feels like the trades are the same. It's just the velocity of the transactions and the number of participants who are going to either add value or percent of cost.
And I think it's important to note that we're all in the business of wanting people to use the content.
Right.
We don't want to prohibit people from using the content. We just want it to be done on a level playing field.
Well, I think, and I'd love to hear from you, especially about film. But when I listen to this conversation, I think that, you know, what often happens at the end of this is you have a business development team, you have a legal team, and you go around and you secure rights that work for the licensor. And then once everything is done, you go to your IT department with a stack of contracts and you know, different systems to integrate and say, okay, great, build that, because now we've done all these deals. And that's where...
Great point. Don't do that.
Exactly.
At least have a concept of what your administrative plan is going to be before you make the deals.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And try to make them as uniform as possible. You can vary the rate or certain... But if you have a different methodology for accounting every single deal you have, it's going to be very expensive to administer.
But I don't necessarily think that you wouldn't want to innovate when it comes to the deal structure.
Not at all.
I think you should be careful how far you go.
Yep.
And I think you should be modeling that to make sure. But some of the most innovative deals have resulted in some of the best opportunities for creators and for their representatives. So, I mean, I would caution not to allow, you know, not to prevent people from thinking outside the box. That's how brands got involved initially, is they found ways to get their message out without detracting from the message of the content itself.
Talk a little bit about film.
Yeah, sure. So I was going to pick up on something you said a minute ago about branding of content, and that's because I would say if I had to pick something that's changed over time, or changed particularly recently in this space, it's about the content having a brand. And I think we get criticized a lot because on the film side, theatrical, you tend to see that all the big studios are focusing on a handful of core properties and then just milking as much as they can out of that. You see, you know, Disney pumping out Marvel movie after Marvel movie. They're very brand conscious in that way, trying to keep Marvel at the forefront and maintain a brand context around that, and so they're very careful about where they'll license that type of thing. In television, it comes up with a lot of these content aggregators, so a lot of content now is consumed through OTT platforms and SVOD platforms like Netflix and Hulu, where the network that originally aired that show put a lot of effort into branding that program and identifying it as a Fox show, as an ABC show. And you lose that when you watch it on Netflix or Hulu. And so one hedge, if you've noticed in recent seasons on Fox shows, most of them at the beginning on the title card will say Fox Presents and then the name of the show. So Fox Presents Empire, FX Presents American Crime Story, things like that. That's all a hedge against this kind of new economy we're in, where content's being consumed all over the place. And we're really working on building brands for that, those content channels. You also said a minute ago that multi-channel is dying, and I agree with that, or at least it's declining. But those brands are persisting. So I think FX, for example, is betting on, when you watch a show on FX, you know it's an FX show because of the context that, you know, because of the darkness, the grittiness, the kind of characteristics of that content that have become known as an FX show. And so it may go away on your cable system. That may not be the way we consume it anymore. But because you like FX, you're going to subscribe to the FX OTT platform if and when that becomes available.
Absolutely.
That's the kind of transition we're seeing in that space.
So it seems like what we're hearing from all the panelists are that the value exchange is often down to money. It's around parity of, I think my content is worth this, and I think that I'm going to bring more to your service than you're going to perhaps bring to me. From the licensee side, in an enterprise that's going into the content distribution business, they want customer adoption, they want engagement, they want a way to communicate to their consumers. And the core of all of this is also data and the ability for both sides to understand, once the content's released and out into the wild, what's happening with it. Is it working? Are consumers engaging? Is your music being heard or your film being watched or the book being read in a way that you want? Where does that level of operation need to sit? Should it be outsourced? Should it be in-house in big on the licensee side? Do the licensors actually understand what's working and what isn't working?
Okay. So, as a music publisher, the data comes to us on a slow rollout. So it takes us a long time to get to a point where we can analyze and have any real impact on what's happening in the sphere as a music publisher. Months and months and months, okay? Quarterly, semi-annually, it's a longer turnover. On the record company side, you're seeing data report to you on a monthly basis or almost instantaneously through people like Nielsen and SoundScan and different types of services, looking at charting on different, streaming services. We're able to react much more quickly. Not instantaneously, but much more quickly. So all of that is extremely valuable to our day-to-day business, knowing even before we make deals what the impact is going to be so that we can be prepared for that. If we're going to make a content deal for a streaming television show or a real, terrestrial television show, what the difference is going to affect the sales of the record later down the road, all of that information is really important in order for us to be prepared to react and to be proactive about it. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the publishing, the comments you've made about publishing, about that trickles in over months and months and months. Why is that? Why can you get the data from on the label side in almost a dashboard, instantaneous, but you can't on the publishing?
Well, you can get some information. You can get the SoundScan information, you can get some of the streaming information, but overall, the way that music publishing royalties are traditionally accounted for is on a longer realm. So when you're looking at actuality of numbers, the response time is different, and it's just a traditional basis based on contracts. It's totally different. But you want to add to that?
Yeah, certainly. To be fair, we send you reports every month, right? 20 days after the close of the month, which is pretty darn fast, super transparent, mm-hmm. web-enabled, customized to go into your content management system.
But not on everything.
All streaming services,
That you work with, yes. That you work with, yes.
Second of all, you're right, labels do work into their contracts. They get weekly crash reports and they get monthly usage reports, which is just something that they bargained for by contract because they have a direct relationship with the DSPs in that context. Let's just look at the DSPs for a moment because it's simpler. But the longer turnarounds that come to the publishers are due to the publisher's own organizations. It's because that money is going through ASCAP or through Harry Fox Agency traditionally to get to you. If you had a direct deal with those rights users, you'd get reporting much faster and more transparently.
Right.
Interesting. No, there's one wrinkle in that you can't speed up. So Bill's right. You can get the data. You can actually understand what's happening. Generally speaking, in near real time. In fact, the technology is already all over the network. When you look at the two major points of value entry into digital content distribution, the first one, generally speaking, of consumers, although they're not really buying a lot, but they're spending dollars. And then there's subsidies coming in from marketers. Those are generally the origination points. There are some other interesting ones, but generally speaking, they fall into two big camps. Consumer dollars are knowable. They're actually knowable at the point of sale, no doubt about it. There's a dispute mechanism, there's potential for even returns on subscription services. You gotta watch churn and so forth, but they're knowable. On the subsidized distribution side of the house, it's actually even more knowable. In fact, the participants involved in the ad tech world and the marketers involved have asserted their right to be able to know how well a campaign is going. They're the ones that are going to write the check. So they need to know whether or not they're getting the reach, whether or not the demographic that they're trying to reach is actually seeing what's going on. The beaconing technology that we employ and others have employed, we use it on the content side, on the demand side, is available. And as Bill said, it's true. That data can make its way all the way across the valley. In fact, it can make it onto every dashboard pretty quickly. However, the wrinkle is the value chain itself. So if you have a distributor, direct to consumer, meaning it's their audience, this is before you think about syndication, generally speaking, you're dealing with revenue recognition issues. So depending on how they're structured, regardless of kind, and nobody's ever gonna agree to do something they can't do. So they, at least there's a 30-day lag in stating what you made and therefore telling someone else what they're gonna get. Add to that the potential that the distributor has cash flow issues because they need to be able to make good. They're likely to extend that to that 45-day mark, if not all the way to 60 days. That's the first half. Sometimes that distributor, especially in new networks, are involved, are actually the content owner themselves, meaning they have the rights to distribute, so they're actually going to handle the payment back to the talent, not necessarily in the very traditional world of music, but definitely in video. So in that case, there's no doubt about it. They're going to wait for cash before they make good. So now you're usually talking about an additional cycle. And that's just a reality. Even if you do point of sale, even if you instantaneously tell someone what's going on, the dollars have to come in. I mean, you can't disadvantage an enterprise where you have cooperation to go to market by saying, okay, and you put it all up. There will be no innovation. You'll have to go to the VC community, which then means that you'll extract way more value out of the ecosystem, which is basically taking money out of the hands of creators. While it is important that data be available and information, and even then making sure you understand that this is the internet, so what you think is going on isn't necessarily what happened. You know, there's all kinds of issues, there's all kinds of faulty transactions, there's all kinds of applications that are used to essentially pump up numbers. The fact of the matter is you can know what's going on and you can understand trends, but the value flow itself has required hurdles. And in fact, it reduces risk for everyone if those hurdles are really there.
So this is actually really important because we've spent a lot of time in this session as well as others talking about blockchain, the possibility of blockchain and what that means and transparency and instantaneous and data flow and the persistence of information. But there's actually strong business cases and business reasons for some of the middlemen that blockchain has the potential to cut out for existence. Do you feel like there's a room for these kinds of business practices to coexist with a more modern technology that could be the web that underpins all of this complexity in transparency?
Well, I think so. I think that at the very first transaction, the very first trade, absolutely. It's likely that it's a content owner, connected with the distribution outlet. That's not usually the creator when you're talking about premium content and when you're talking about emerging talent that's under contract. So it's likely to be that it just means that there'll be value distribution between the content owner and the platform immediately. But there's still revenue recognition issues that you'll have. So you're still likely to engage in the regular practice of seeing what you've done, verifying what you've done, and then paying. It's just cash will move faster, if
it
you will.
It will move faster.
It'll move faster.
It will be faster.
It will be faster.
It's instantaneous.
But it won't be instantaneous. It's just you set up the risk of having essentially funding disputes. And you will lose track of the other entities that are not falsely, let's say, incorrectly attributed as owning something, and therefore the settlement opportunities will create another industry around trying to slow this down so that people are paid accurately.
Let me try to see if I can pull together a couple of things that you guys have said and try and simplify this. You made a great point about the fact that there are lots of reasons why slower payment is more sensible.
And I'll make the heretical statement that speed of payment is not necessarily an objective worth chasing. Okay? The flash reports that the record labels get are designed to provide that frontline immediate response. What's working? What's trending? Where is it happening? And it's valuable, but it's not necessarily reliable for the purposes of accounting. I would rather have my money 45 days later and have it accounted to me correctly, so I don't have to waste business cycles fixing it, making cross payments, correcting things, adjusting. That's a waste of time and energy for everybody. So I would much rather have rapid flash reporting to serve those needs, and later more methodical reporting. And the publishing area is super important, not as important in your catalog. You have a very specific catalog, but catalogs that are constantly pushing out new material, especially complex new material, urban material with lots of publishers on it, the information about who owns that work is not going to be available for months after that piece of music hits the marketplace. That's just the publishing business. You can talk to the composers and the publishers about why that is, but that's what is. So a system that provides some slack in between for that data to catch up and then accounts on the basis of that data, when and if that data is arriving, makes a lot more sense, as long as it doesn't lose the usage files from previous periods and goes back and accounts retroactively when that information finally catches up. As long as you have those two things put together, that makes a lot of sense.
We just have a few minutes left. Are there any audience questions? Because if not, I will. I'd love to just ask each of you to talk a little bit about what advice you have for where you see the industry is going and some of the pitfalls that you've seen that you would recommend not continue in the future. Bill, I think you're kind of at the forefront of a lot of this with the publishing and the systems that you've set up. What are the things that you're looking at for the future state of our business of streaming and billion line streaming reports?
If I had to boil down everything that I'm concerned about into one topic, it would be education. Because to me, the accounting systems are very mature. The tracking systems are very mature. The reporting systems are very mature now. All of the infrastructure is there. What's missing is rapid promulgation of the data in the original instance, which is one of the reasons that I haven't yet been able to get my head around the blockchain problem, because it's that first mile that's the problem. If we could educate every creator of content in every medium that the most important thing they can do as soon as they create something that they're really proud of is put down the metadata for it and know what metadata is and which metadata is relevant and how to order it, that would be the thing that would solve all the problems.
So you two were both nodding when he said education.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly the same thing, actually, but from a slightly different perspective, which is that we are in a world now where we have more creators than we've ever had before, and more opportunities for that creative material to be exploited than ever before. And I think it's sort of to your point about middlemen a minute ago. I think we are now more than ever actually need people in the middle to help educate each side on rights, responsibilities, and how those ecosystems work. Because with anyone with a phone in here can participate in any of the industries represented up here today. And that's great on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's an opportunity for a big mess. And so as people start to realize the value of that material. So I think education as well is very important.
Yeah, I mean, I would just go to the point of worrying before in a few earlier panels about how are we gonna capture all this data from our past, and I would just wipe that away for a while, and let's just say, starting now, we're all gonna go forward capturing this kind of information from the beginning, which enables so much more activity and monetization. And again, it's the education issue of having people understand that's the important thing.
I recently had a talk about this, and I said education as well. There was a time when it was very difficult for people to get their heads around the fact that they even had rights, or that others had rights for that matter. People were incensed that they had to ask for permission to do something. Now it's a deal killer. Even some of the latest networks that launch clearly know, and some of the platforms that have finally matured are doing what they're supposed to do to prevent the mass infringement of people's rights, essentially of copyright. So education, try out what you're trying to do in safe places first, where you know there's a good audience, where you know the platform is safe. But at the same time, also keep trying to innovate. I mean, keep trying to reach people differently. Keep partnering. Partnering is a great thing, even in the creative world. You can set standards for how to do it very rapidly. Look at what, again, we don't like to say multi-channel networks, but look at the YouTube MCNs, where they, a lot of them are now going out pre-licensing audio tracks so that they can give their creators stuff that they can work with. So it's clear that they're working with safe material, that that's, nobody's going to get sued for using. So those kinds of things, work with those kind of companies to continue to provide a much more safe distribution experience.
So I agree about education, but I also think that transparency is going to be the key here. We all have to let each other know what we own, what we control, what our percentages are. We can't hold that information back from everybody that wants to use our content. We have to be able to follow the metadata through the chain. I mean, we've had experiences where, as a record company, we've input the metadata, it goes to the distributor sends it to the DSP sends it to the licensing agent for the mechanical license, and it comes back to us as a publisher totally different, as if we're playing this whole big, you know, telephone game where the record company is wrong and there's one digit off from the ISRC, but the song title's right, the album's, I mean, and we can't figure out where in the chain is the kink. So we need transparency about who owns what. We need transparency about the metadata being supplied and how it's being pushed out amongst everybody as well.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you to the audience.
We have a break now for meet you back here in a bit.
It's really good. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.